Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, and today we will talk about China's latest attempt to internationalize the currency, the RMB. This episode is part of Zhonghua Mundus, our series about global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter under the same name. The link to subscribe is in the show notes. I am happy to have today Alicia Garcia Herrero, our senior fellow, and also Alessia Amigni. Hello both, how are you?
Hello Yuyun, how are you doing?
Good, thank you Alicia. How are you, Alessia?
Hello Yuyun, thanks.
Thank you for joining me today. So recently, Alessia and Alicia co-authored a paper, Third Time Lucky, China's Push to Internationalize the Renminbi. I'm going to ask Alessia to start giving us an overview of the paper that you wrote together.
So the idea to write this paper was fostered by the increase in the use of the RMB since 2022, or at least of everybody talking about the increasing usage of RMB in international transactions since the start of the Ukraine war after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with the sanctions to transaction in US dollars. So we decided to write this paper to account for this, you know, slight increase in use of RMB in international transactions and to compare this new wave or push by China to use their RMB internationally to previous attempts. So the idea was to compare the different factors that are pushing the RMB out of China, so to say, including institutional factors, which we will talk about in a minute, and then factors that actually are kind of building an international demand for RMB, despite the fact that the RMB is not convertible currency, meaning that it doesn't circulate outside of China. So this was the basic idea. And the title, Third Time Lucky, means that maybe this third time is more successful than the first and the second in terms of increasing the international use of the RMB.
Thank you, Alessia. As you have mentioned in the topic, this time is called the Third Time Lucky. So I would like to ask Alicia, what was the time when China made it first and the second attempt, and why has it not worked before?
In the paper, we talk about the different ways in which China has tried in the past to internationalize the currency until today. And the first attempt is one that, in a way, characterizes the RMB as a non-convertible currency. Only when a currency is not convertible and you try to internationalize it, you need an extra push, and that is the offshore market. That is indeed Hong Kong. That is how it all started. So, keeping the capital controls, trying to use the RMB offshore through RMB deposits in Hong Kong. And this is how we created this CNH, the renminbi offshore, as opposed to CNY, the renminbi onshore. So that's how we started creating demand pools of liquidity of RMB outside, starting with Hong Kong, then Singapore, London, you name it. What's the problem? What was the problem? Why it didn't work? Because first of all, yes, why not have a deposit in RMB in Hong Kong with a nice yield at the time the RMB was appreciating and actually offering quite a nice yield for speculation? Why not? But the problem is there were no products in assets in RMB offshore, CNH, that could yield that. So it was very artificial. You see that the yield was in the mainland, but the deposit was offshore and you had to arbitrage that. And it just didn't work. The end of it, in a way, although it's not fully ended, I mean, we still have offshore deposits, but kind of the collapse of the whole thing started in 2015 because there was suddenly this piling up of the value of the RMB, always higher, always better, suddenly stopped. And interestingly, it was the PBOC to stop that because it was like the thing that was feeding speculation, always stronger RMB. So the PBOC stopped it in 2014. And then everybody started selling off these deposits in Hong Kong. And the RMB offshore became much cheaper, quite much cheaper than onshore. That was a problem for the PBOC, two values of the RMB. So they intervened in that offshore market to the point of making it basically a non-market, a non-separate market, a non-private market, a non-market. And it became much more like the onshore market. So that was kind of the first attempt trying to create a market while keeping capital controls in the mainland. And that was the first attempt.
And the second attempt, I think we've talked about it in an earlier episode. It was more about the digitalization of the RMB. Alicia, could you tell us what happened there and how did it go that time?
On the second attempt, Alicia and I have had discussions and we wouldn't really say that it was a failure. We would rather say that I didn't work out as quickly as expected. The main reason probably was COVID. So let me clarify. So what China said, okay, what about the digital currency? A currency that in a way seems free, but you know, we have a centralized ledger. We know where the money is going. We can control the outflows, the inflows. You know, I'm talking about the cross-border use, obviously, of China's digital currency. And all of that seemed possible with memorandum of understanding with different central banks in the world, Thailand, United Arab Emirates, etc. But, you know, in a very constrained and kind of step-by-step approach. But COVID came, and that meant that not because it was meant to be used by Chinese tourists or travelers going overseas using their own currency, digital currency, in their wallets, Alipay, not substituting WeChat or Alipay, but using as a legal tender elsewhere, overseas, the RMB in, say, Thailand rather than the Thai baht. But they were not tourists anymore in COVID. So, you know, nobody brought that money outside of e-money out of China. But let's be frank, this is coming back. The second attempt is delayed. It doesn't mean it has disappeared.
Okay. So yeah, indeed, because now we're seeing the end of the zero COVID policy and now China is reopening again. And this year there is a lot of visa attempts in order to attract tourists back and also like sending Chinese tourists again abroad. So maybe what you're saying is this year we're going to see more development on this. And also in other central bank side, we're also seeing a lot of progress in digital currencies. So maybe this is still an area to look out for. Alessia, do you want to add something?
Yes, sure. The digital RMB is there to stay. And if we were a little bit surprised to have this, you know, efforts, attempts to use it cross-border, despite the very many statements, official statements that the ERMB was intended to be used domestically, but in the meantime, the Bank for International Settlements were trying to figure out the technical issues linked to the cross-border use. And this is intended mostly for Chinese residents going abroad, so being able to use their own currency. Also, the wholesale is already, say, digitalized in a sense, because, you know, the clearing is overnight and it's not, of course, by cash, but it's, you know, electronic.
We will take a short break and when we come back, we will talk about the third attempt to internationalize the RMB. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Alessia, could you tell us about the third attempt to internationalize the RMB?
There are now, I mean, overlapping tools or mechanisms to have this kind of demand rise for RMB outside of China, besides the ERMB, and they both, the two major institutional efforts to, you know, start this demand outside of China were around in between 2013 and 2015. And in 2015, most notably, the inclusion of the RMB in the special drawing right basket within the IMF, this kind of, you know, fiat money, you know, which is actually used to compute the quotas, national quotas within the IMF, was kind of misread, I would say, by the international community as being something or only symbolic or nothing, you know, different from the past. Instead, this very moment in 2015 was very important for Chinese policymakers because it, first of all, comforted policymakers in China that indeed, without opening up the capital account, the RMB could find its own way into the international financial system. And secondly, central banks had to reshuffle their portfolio of reserve currencies to include the RMB. This was kind of misread and also, in a sense, downplayed by observers, because this very increase in RMB reserves abroad was the first step to kind of, you know, make the RMB accepted internationally, despite the fact that, you know, it was still not convertible. And the second of such institutional mechanisms is something very accepted, acknowledged internationally, which is a kind of an agreement between pairs of central banks called bilateral swap lines. It's just, you know, pools of liquidity sent, you know, of course, virtually, digitally, between pairs of central banks. Say the People's Bank of China agrees with, say, the Bank of Italy or a number of now very many banks around the world, more than 70, I think, even more maybe, while we are talking now, in such a way that when liquidity is needed, if it is needed, these pools of liquidity of RMB and exchange with the currency of the partner country can be activated. So everybody has the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan. But China started to use this kind of very simple and neutral mechanism for having liquidity abroad in a massive and serial way. So now has dozens of such swap lines, and their maturity is much longer than usual, than average swap lines from other central banks, up to 3 years. Meaning that it's intended to be used by partner countries for circumstances where they need liquidity for payments, say if they are short on dollars, as you know, Argentina repeatedly found herself, they can activate such RMB. Of course, the RMB, you can use it to pay China so far. These two mechanisms were the triggers, so to say, of an international demand, although it's not a retail demand, but it's, you know, more on an institutional level. But it started what we envisage as a increasing demand for RMB outside of China.
Alicia, do you have something to add on to the third attempt?
Yes, perhaps how dichotomy of its success. I would summarize it like that. It's been very successful on trade settlements, but on with very specific countries, not everybody, Belt and Road, and especially countries with sanctions, Russia, or, you know, Latin America, Argentina, less so Brazil, but increasingly, but, you know, countries that have, in a way, obtained something in exchange, whether it's bypassing subsidies, sanctions, or in the case of Argentina, access to the bilateral swap agreement with the PBOC funding. So, you know, it's not like a fully natural process, I would say. And secondly, on the funding, we need to realize that this is happening because access to dollar funding was so expensive and so difficult that, you know, I may as well accept RMB, nothing left. Yeah. And so in a way, the question is, will it continue if other sources of funding are available? And it's hard to tell because it's a very skewed type of funding, because when you get RMB funding, you need to use it mostly, being a non-convertible currency, for imports from the mainland. Yeah, so it constrains your ability to import from elsewhere. So it has limitations. The dichotomy comes from the fact that it is the RMB is not internationalizing on the investment side, meaning if you look at the composition of foreign reserves of central bank, there is no increase in RMB use. There's no increase in RMB investment by private investors onshore in the mainland. Actually, it is decreasing. So, you know, it's a very dual situation for funding if I need it, and for trade if I desperately need it. But otherwise, for investment or if I'm a developed economy, I may not accept RMB for trade settlements. I may not invest in the mainland as much as I used to.
And how would you explain this kind of discrepancy between the increased need for funding and trade and the decreasing need from an investment side?
Alessia said it already in the sense that it is all about capital account convertibility. If I'm an investor and I have choices, I am not very keen on a currency that is depreciating, increasingly low interest rates, lower than, by the way, US dollar, 200 basis points. Why would I go? But if I have fewer choices and I'm asking for money, yeah, then I may as well accept what I'm able to receive, you know? So it's this dichotomy. So whether it's not convertible, if I'm funding myself, it's not a big deal. If I'm investing and I need to leave, that's a big deal. So it's really about what the RMB is today that explains where it has managed to be used more internationally, funding and trade for a specific.
Thank you for that. And as you said, it's also like a more passive response. It's because like the use of dollar is having more restrictions. And what about the euro side? How has the euro been doing? And does that also lead to some reasoning of RMB is being more used internationally? Alessia, do you want to answer that?
Yes, indeed. This is a little bit of a puzzle in the recent composition of currencies in international transactions, because despite the economic sanctions through the dollar and, of course, also through the euro due to the extraterritoriality conditions of economic sanctions, we see that actually the slight increase in the use of the RMB was accompanied by a decrease in the use of the euro, not the dollar. So we will see in the next few months what is happening. It could be that, you know, the dollar is still, you know, the international currency and you can only have one. The second or third are just, you know, aiming at having a kind of a decent share, but they're not competing with the dollar. So it could be that in very turbulent times, with a lot of instability, financial, economic, and geopolitical, the dollar, despite the sanctions, of course, not from countries' sanctions and transactions on the blacklist, was considered as being, you know, safer than the euro. But this still we cannot say. What we can add to the picture here is that there is a very clear distinction between the behavior of BRI participants in terms of use of RMB and non-BRI. And indeed, the financial cooperation, as it is called, is one of the pillars of the BRI, maybe a little bit neglected by many observers, because, you know, transports and logistics and many other areas of connectivity have been studied much more than the financial connectivity. But this is very important, as we find that BRI countries tend to receive investment from China increasingly in RMB. Of course, that is a very major reason for them to want to be willing to pay trade with China in RMB, which doesn't happen for non-BRI countries. So the institutional trigger is very evident, because, of course, if not in the BRI, countries wouldn't have any reason to accept investment in RMB and so on and so forth. So this is why we argue that the market forces are there, but somehow they are facilitated by institutional agreements. By themselves, with a non-convertible currency, you wouldn't have a market for RMB outside of China, but with the right institutional triggers, this is happening. And this is precisely what we want to showcase in the paper.
And do you also see a trend in other institutions, like, for example, the BRICS members? Are they also increasingly using the RMB? Alicia?
Given that Russia is part of the BRICS, surely, but not, I mean, and India is also using RMB to pay for oil from Russia, but for the same reason. So, you know, if you count on that, actually, when you look at the offshore oil derivatives markets, there's not an increase in RMB payments. So I would say still for commodity markets is not so obvious because these are very liquid markets. You know, they need basically convertibility. It's not so easy for that. But overall, because the BRICS are so dominated by, you know, like kind of trespassing sanctions, call it that way, situation, of course, it's increasing. But I don't think it is the case beyond basically the oil purchases of the largest importer, whether it's, you know, of course, India in the case of the BRICS and the exporter, Russia.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about the impact of RMB as a rising international currency. Welcome back, Alessia. Now that China is gaining more importance in international currency, what impact this is bringing to the global financial system?
Well, still, if you consider the use of RMB on total global transactions, the share is very small, below 3%. So it doesn't have really an impact globally. But on certain geographies, considering certain bilateral relations between China and Russia, say China and India, as mentioned before, of course, it is gaining some kind of importance. More than 50% of now bilateral trade between Russia and China are settled in RMB. And this, of course, has given Russia a way to circumvent sanctions by the US, economic sanctions and financial sanctions. And this acts as a motivation for China to kind of build an area of circulation of the RMB, let's call it. It's very grand, but it's, you know, kind of a increasing area of circulation of RMB between China and selected very important partners, which may serve the purpose of protecting China in case of economic sanctions against Beijing. Of course, this is very out of, you know, any scenario now, but China, you know, has a very long time frame when designing its policy measures and initiatives, and they are for sure thinking about this kind of possibility, and they want to protect, which is very understandable. So up to now, there's no real impact on the financial system, but it may have a lot of impact if China, a number of major partners, and maybe more, accept the RMB, and maybe not only for trade transactions. I remember once in the Financial Times, some couple of years ago, around mid-August, nobody maybe read it in the midsummer, reporting statement by the Indonesian president suggesting why they wouldn't accept using the RMB in Indonesia as a national currency. So this was totally shocking to me because this is not under discussion. So it could be that incentives and interests are piling up to a point that they actually kind of build a demand for RMB in some countries, particularly linked to China or with, you know, special interests to circumvent the dollar. And, you know, overnight we will find that somewhere it will happen.
Will we see a global fragmentation of the financial market if it keeps going this way, Alicia?
Yes, I think we will see a fragmentation, but not only because of the RMB. It's because eventually, you know, when other, say India, yeah, I mean, it's of course very early, but it's a large, huge market. There were more IPOs in India than in Hong Kong or the mainland for that matter this year. So, you know, the Indians will say, why not me? Why not my Indian rupee? Why not? You know, so everybody will try to, I would say, weaponize its currency, not only the RMB. I don't think people will just accept the RMB for a very simple reason. It's not very liquid. There is no offshore liquidity. So what I think will happen, and this is your fragmentation, totally right, is that there will be more currencies. Yeah. So, you know, Brazil might try to work on the real regionally, you know, like everybody will try to push its currency in its neighborhood. This is very bad news for the euro because, you know, we're losing market share in terms of SWIFT settlements, going back to your question on the euro. And the more this regionalization of trend, the more this will be the case. So I would say more than a threat to the dollar, it's a threat to the euro because we're not really the reserve currency of the world. You know, if push comes to shove, the switch will be faster euro than dollar, in my view. And this is why we should be very attentive to what's going on here.
What can the euro do in order to strengthen its position?
Maybe I would call market-driven forces, but still some forces. For example, creating our capital market union. This is obvious, yeah? We don't have a liquid capital market. We also have, and this is a question of a consequence of the European sovereign crisis and the global financial crisis, we don't have enough AAA paper in the euro area. So this calls for more centralization of debt issuance at the European level. This is, of course, a taboo for some, but maybe they should realize that that the cost of not doing it is pretty high in terms of the international use of the euro. So these two things are the most obvious. We could talk about others, but these are very obvious.
So before I close this episode, Alicia, do you have any final comments to add on?
Yeah, I would just say that the internationalization of the RMB is under research, especially in Europe. We focus, as Alessia said, on infrastructure, many, many things. But frankly, the euro is one of our great assets. This is why we have, among other reasons, European Monetary Union. So we should focus on this. We should realize that this is a threat. It could also be an opportunity, but we should know more about what could be the consequences for the euro of this rise of the RMB.
Alessia, anything to add?
Yes, I would just add that the ambitions by Chinese policymakers, which we have a little bit underestimated in some circumstances, notably as regards financial policies, both domestically and internationally. This relates to the under-research of the RMB, but also of the channels through which China is linking financially, of course, currency-wise, but also financially to other countries. And the investment in RMB is through both state and private actors is very relevant. But we still, you know, think that this is something that doesn't lead to anything. It may not.
Thank you very much, both. I would like to remind our listeners that you can find Alessia and Ladicia's paper, Third Time Lucky, China's Push to Internationalize the RMB, in the show notes. And you can also read all our other research by our scholars on our website, brugo.org. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.